He'll come back for the second. India have won the test match. India have won the series. They're going to get back for two. India home. Lords goes wild.
Hey, what is up? This is the 81 All Out podcast, and I'm Subhash Jayaraman at Cricket Couch on Twitter. In this episode, we're going to look at the six teams that got eliminated from the 2019 World Cup. And joining me to talk about them are first, Peter De La Penna, a trailblazing cricket correspondent for ESPN Cricinfo from the United States. Welcome, Peter.
I genuflect to you, Subhash.
Hey, belated 4th of July to you, buddy.
Happy 4th of July. Happy Independence Day.
Fantastic. And also joining us is Karthike Date, who's a regular contributor to this podcast and as well as ESPN Cricinfo. Welcome to the show, Karthike.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks. Let's start from the bottom of the points table, starting with Afghanistan. Peter, you are an expert. You have covered a lot more Afghanistan.
That's a rumor. That's a fake news rumor you're putting out there. I got to cut you off there. Allegedly.
You've covered Afghanistan, when they were an associate nation, seen them a lot more than me and Karthike put together, definitely. So what did you make of their campaign? Did you think they performed to their capabilities, or they could have done better? After all, they came so close to knocking off a few of the teams.
I think they may have been the only team that peaked in the warm-up matches, which is obviously not the route you want to go to in the World Cup. I mean, they looked fantastic in the game they played against Pakistan in the warm-up game. And they showed what they're capable of in that. They showed what they were capable of in the World Cup qualifier last year, winning the tournament, beating West Indies twice at that event. And then they came into here at this World Cup almost like they were drunk on their own success of beating teams at that second tier level and coming off at that high of beating Pakistan. I saw them in Scotland. They came in, had a brief tour of Scotland. They played one match in Edinburgh, one match got rained out, but they played one completed match and they looked good. Without Mohammed Abi and Rashid Khan. And keep in mind, Scotland beat them last year at the qualifier, beat them quite convincingly at the qualifier with Rashid Khan, with Mohammed Abi, with Mujibur Rahman. All three of those guys were not there at the match they played in May in Scotland. So without the three big guns to win that match in the way that they did, it was a tight victory on Duckworth Lewis, but they won. And then those guys come back, they beat Pakistan in the warm-up match. It just to have the tournament they did was something that was unexpected for me, and I think they would readily admit they performed well below their expectations. Nobody's going to kid you and con you and say, oh, they were going to make the semifinals. No, but they were certainly in, I would say, three matches they played. And in particular, I would say the Sri Lanka match was the one that, if they had to do over again, that's the one that really slipped away quite badly from them.
Karthike, you tweeted as soon as that match ended about how Afghanistan had a very good World Cup. So explain that.
Oh, I didn't expect them to win any game. But I think they
came. You haven't been following them close enough because, as Peter says, they were good enough to win. They have shown that they have the capability and they did well before the World Cup, as well as they ran four of the teams close.
Yeah, I was surprised that they ran the teams close in a couple of games, as close as they did. I don't think they were ever in. I don't think in any of the games they were given their team and given what they were faced with. I don't think they were ever in a position of where they could say they were clearly ahead in any game. They were competitive for far longer than I thought they would be, and that's why I think they had an outstanding World Cup. I think my sense of Afghanistan is from the last year's Asia Cup, and in Asia, in those conditions, firstly, their batting goes much further. Secondly, their spinners go much further than I thought they would in England. And especially on the batting side, I think they missed a lot of quality. I mean, if you look at their record over the 9 games in the tournament, they lost a wicket more frequently than once every 30 balls. So they were, over a 50-over innings, they were always going to get bowled out. They didn't have a single batsman who averaged more than 30, as far as if I'm right. But that was never the point of Afghanistan being in the World Cup. That's also why I thought that Scotland should have been in the World Cup and Ireland should have been in the World Cup and a couple of other teams should have been in the World Cup. Like up to 14th in the table, or even 16th in the table, they should have been in the World Cup. Mm-hmm. Because the point is not for them to be competitive. The point is for them to be there. You know, because it's a showcase of the world game and they're part of it because they play year in and year out. And, you know, they play now in all the leagues and they should have been there. I think one of the differences between when all the bigger teams visit, play Afghanistan in other tournaments or in like one-off bilateral series and this World Cup is that in the World Cup, Afghanistan run into all these teams at full throttle. Whereas in Asia Cup and all these tournaments, the big teams will like rest players. They will try out things. Okay. They're not really going as hard as they usually would. Whereas over here, I mean, Owen Morgan is not going to spare them, you know.
How much of an effect was, replacing Asghar Afghan with the Gulbuddin Naib before the tournament, and also, you know, one of the talismanic character of Afghanistan cricket, Mohammad Shehzad, being sent away home a few games into the tournament. You know, if Afghan is the captain, Gulbuddin Naib does not bowl that over against Imad Wasim in Pakistan. Maybe he doesn't. I don't know.
Well, forget about not bowling. He might not even be in the 11. He might not even be playing in that match.
What do you think of that?
Like, let's go a step further. Yeah, Gulbuddin Naib is not by any means an automatic selection in the 11. I mean, in terms of team balance, putting him in the 11 as the captain, you've thrown off the team balance by essentially you're forced to either keep out a batsman or potentially keep out a bowler because you've got an extra kind of seam option with him in there. And that was exposed when Najibullah was left out in that third match, which was absurd. If Gulbuddin is not captain and Asghar is the captain at the start of this tournament, that third match, Gulbuddin is the guy who's going to be left out, not Najibullah, because he's your best informed batsman. And they were trying to fit square pegs into round holes when Mohammad Shehzad was cut loose early in the tournament, and that was kind of a tactical snafu that they made, which I don't think would have happened if you don't have Gulbuddin taking up a place in the 11 guaranteed as captain, because you could have taken him out in a game, and he's always been a player who's, I would say he's probably 7th, 8th, 9th on the team sheet over the last couple of years. He's nowhere near close to being the first name on the team sheet, and inability to have that flexibility by moving him in or out, depending on your team combinations, depending on Shehzad going out injured or whatever, that posed a problem in addition to just the general instability by the shakeup of team chemistry by not having Asghar Afghan as the captain to start the World Cup when he had been so inspirational in the qualifier and respected at the qualifier. Remember, he had that emergency appendectomy in Zimbabwe, and Rashid Khan, who everybody puts on a pedestal, myself first and foremost, he was the vice captain. They made him captain, and it was a disaster. They lost three games in the group stage, and they were pleading for Asghar. Like, he wasn't even close to 100%, but they're like, you gotta, even if you're 60%, 70% with your appendicitis patched up, like, get on the field because we need you out there. And Rashid is under too much pressure trying to manage bowling changes and whatever else, and it showed. When he came back, they were a different team in that qualifier, beating the West Indies twice, beating Ireland, and eventually getting through to the World Cup.
From a team that was so dependent on a singular personality, let's move on to another team that was that seemed to be dependent on a single approach. Let's talk about West Indies, Kartikeya. You know, looking at West Indies players, you know, household names, you know, T20 stars, and the way they beat the crap out of Pakistan first game in Nottingham, people would have had higher hopes of West Indies, but they just barely managed to beat out Afghanistan for the wooden spoon, right? Or not to get the wooden spoon. What did you make of West Indies' team and their approach in this tournament?
Oh, I think actually their World Cup was, they came here, they sort of seemed to play in this sort of C50 overs as an expanded T20 game. You know, they scored a lot of boundaries. They scored more boundaries per 50 overs than almost anybody. I think they did like 34. But when they were not scoring boundaries, they're basically scoring at like 42, 43 runs per 100 balls. Mm-hmm. Now, what most teams manage when they're not scoring boundaries is about somewhere in the region of 55 to 60 runs per 100 balls. And in T20, that difference doesn't matter, because the number of non-boundary balls to boundary balls, that ratio is much higher, much more in favor of boundary balls. Whereas in one-day game, for example, if you compare, say, England and West Indies, and England match West Indies when it comes to scoring boundaries, but when the rest of the balls, England take about 45 runs more per 300 balls from compared to the West Indies.
Yeah.
You know, so they have this... The other thing they had was, you know, they didn't really have a middle order. Nicholas Puran coming into this series, his best score in all cricket he's played was 89. And he's batting basically in, as in the specialist positions. So there's
4 and 5, yeah.
Short of confidence. I felt with the, looking at the West Indies that if this World Cup had been played in 2021, they would probably do very well because their younger players would have two more years of experience and they would not have Gail. And for those two reasons, I think they would do really well in, if this World Cup was like...
Why do you say, make the statement about Gail?
Because I don't think Gail's very, all that... Gail's very, very... not a great ODI player anymore. He doesn't field. He doesn't run between the wickets. He's extremely one-dimensional. And, you know, when that... does, and he seems to hit lots of boundaries, and yet it seems to take him about 10 overs to get to a run a ball. And in the 50-over game, that has a knock-on effect in that the fact that he is such a block-block-swing player, the batsman at the other end is also stuck at the other end. For long periods of time. So there's no stand, there's no... nothing sort of develops when he's batting. You know, but that's the way he plays, and I think at this point in his career, I think that's the only way he can play. I don't think he can play any other way, even if he wants to. So I think they I mean, one of the players I was surprised by, Darren Bravo was never got a look in their top order. So I don't know if it, I don't know whether their World Cup would have been different if they had not played the sort of the scene, the limited overs game as a expanded T20, but,
I mean, it seems
it certainly contributed because yeah. They also don't have a very good bowling attack and they have a lot of pace, but their fast bowlers, except for Kemar Roach, their bowling lacks a little bit of class and they have a lot of tearaways in their attack. And you saw that, especially in the game against Bangladesh, where, you know, any other bowling team above them would have bowled cutters and taken the pace of the ball and kept the pitch the ball up and tried to sort of, you know, strangle the scoring a little bit. And with 320 to play with, that might have gone a long way. But West Indies wanted basically to blast Bangladesh out of the game. And that didn't work because all their short pitch bowling kept getting hammered and they kept bowling short.
I mean, it wasn't just the Bangladesh game. I mean, they did that against Pakistan and they did that against Australia. They did that against England. They did that against Bangladesh, so on and so forth. So let's get Peter. Peter, you know, as Karthikeya mentioned about batting, Gale-driven approach, which is block and hit, block, hit, which is also a kind of a Misbah luck approach to limited overs. What did you make of the bowling approach and, you know, and them tying themselves to Andre Russell's, you know, body that was falling apart?
Well, on the Andre Russell point, there's something that I've had discussions with people related to this that I don't think was fully appreciated, I think, before the World Cup in terms of 50-over cricket. In the context of you had guys like him, Kyron Pollard, Sunil Narine, you can even throw Gale in the mix, guys who more or less had missed out a sizable chunk of ODI cricket for the West Indies and domestic one-day cricket in the Super 50 tournament locally. And it was a lot of it was labeled on, oh, well, they're not being picked because either they haven't made themselves available or because they're chasing T20 dollars and franchise cricket or, you know, Andre Russell, one of Andre Russell's other reasons, I guess, or excuses, whatever you want to label it as, was that he kept on claiming, this is going back to late last year, that he wasn't, quote, 50 over match fit. And I think some people read that and like, come on, that's nonsense. What are you talking about? And as an example of that, I saw him in December. This was like a couple days after West Indies had announced that Russell was not picked to go to Bangladesh for a tour. And I can't remember if it was for the T20 squad or for the 50 over squad as well. He just wasn't picked to go on the tour as far as I can remember. And I was in Florida at the time at the U.S. Open T20 cricket tournament, which I think you may be familiar with, Subhash.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there. He was playing for a team. He was playing with Rusty Tron, and I can't remember who else was in the team. They had some good players, some international caliber players. And he was playing in a match, in a semifinal match, against Ali Khan of the USA. And Ali Khan was with Riyad Emirat and a couple other guys. But basically, he went out there and smashed a century against Ali Khan, and he was just absolutely slaughtering the ball. He looked fantastic. He was bowling 85, 90 miles an hour. He looked great. And people there are like, all right, this is one big con, like him claiming like he's not fit, or the West Indies claiming he's not fit to go play 50 over cricket or to go play at that level internationally. And after seeing him in this tournament, now I start to actually sympathize with that stance, and there's legitimacy behind it now. When guys like Narine claim, I'm not comfortable, or I'm not ready or mentally ready to bowl a 50 over spell, or Bravo, Dwayne Bravo says he can't play 50 over cricket, or there's questions about Gale, or Kyron Pollard about, you know, Kyron Pollard says, oh, I'm not 50 over ready, or the board themselves say, we're not picking him because we haven't seen him play 50 over cricket, and we can't trust that he's going to be fit to play a 50 over match.
Yeah.
That's justified now, based on what we saw with Andre Russell.
True, I get that. By and large, it does make sense, and the table kind of reflects the overall quality in the squad and how the players, you know, whether they were in form, healthy, fit, all that. But at the same time, you know, West Indies had a foot in the door against Australia, and where even though they were kind of crap for most of the game, Carlos Brathwaite brought them to within a meter of winning the match.
Yeah, but that's like that. But it appears that way. Even with Afghanistan, it appeared that way. When they're like 140 for one, chasing 290 or whatever, it appears that they're ahead in the game and they're ahead of the game.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at what they have to come, what batting they have to come. You look at how they've got to 140 for one. And you look at what West Indies have to come and how West Indies are bowling and how they're defending totals. And they give away a lot of free runs and they have, like, the Afghanistan batsmen, like, compared to, like, the better lineups, their batsmen have a lot more holes in their game. And the, like, I was telling you about West Indies' inability to score runs when they're not scoring boundaries. Afghanistan's will score at 39 runs per 100 balls when they're scoring, not scoring boundaries. So when they're not, basically when they don't hit a boundary, and they hit a boundary far less often than any of the other teams. But even when they don't hit a boundary, they have really struggled to keep the bowling out. You know, so it's a leap in class for them. And I'm sure they want to compete, right? Like Bangladesh have always wanted to compete. From 99, 2003, 2007, they always want to compete. And every time they competed better. And we'll come on to Bangladesh, but I think this time they competed better than they ever have. And they're now a legitimate mid-table side.
I think that is the perfect segue to go to look at the case of South Africa. Was AB de Villiers available? Should he have been picked? You know, let's talk about South Africa. You know, the perennial contenders since they were reintroduced into cricket in 1992. What do you think, Peter? Should cricket South Africa sucked it up in the end and then let AB in the squad, or they're right in doing what they did?
I mean, we've had a similar issue that's been a hot button debate within U.S. cricket. Along similar lines of guys making themselves available last minute for whatever reason, if they're a passport holder and they suddenly get discovered, and do you give basically a big middle finger to a guy who's been part of your squad for the better part of 3 years or 4 years, who's been part of your whole build up to the tournament, and just say it, you know, at the 11th hour, Hey, you got to take this one on the chin, pal, because the big show, the franchise is back in town. it's been happening in U.S. cricket. You had a very similar incident, almost a carbon copy, happened in the 2014 T20 World Cup with the Netherlands. Some people might remember, some might forget, when Timothy Grounders, who was a fringe player, to be fair. I mean, if you're given an accurate assessment of him, it wasn't like...
And then they got in Tom Cooper in this place, is that it?
Yeah, and Tom Cooper, who was going to be committed to South Australia, I think he was with at the time, suddenly South Australia didn't make the Shield final, and he became available
I get the scenarios. What would you have done? Would you have gone for AB or no?
If you look at what happened with Netherlands, Tom Cooper helped them in that epic chase against Ireland to win that game. And that put them into the main draw of the T20 World Cup. And after a huge furor 3 days ago, suddenly nobody remembers Timothy Grounders. right? Who cares about him? All sins are forgiven. Hey, Tom Cooper, come on down. So you look at that situation, what are you willing to trade off?
Results. I mean, but sports, you know, say it's a result of business.
Hindsight, you want to pick your best 15. It, all things considered, you should be picking your best 15. If you're looking to pick your best 15, AB de Villiers is in your best 15. There's no questions about it.
Yeah, you pick him up.
And I think I would have. And I tell you why. The argument about, we have this principle stance, blah, 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 blah. We had to stick to morals. Hashim Amla, what did he do to deserve to keep his place in the squad recently? I haven't seen much of him do anything recently. And in the tournament itself, he looked horrendous. And that innings he played against Afghanistan, I thought was one of the most selfish things I've ever seen. Now it doesn't matter. They got knocked out not long after that. But the point is,
he's really screwed up the run rate over there.
It was absurd what he was doing just to help himself. And if you're going to say, well, helping himself to help the team, you can make a claim. I don't buy that. I thought that whole innings, it was so painstaking. That to me, it was along of what Karthikeya is saying about Chris Gayle. Hashim Amla is not an easy player to bat with. If you're batting at the other end, if you're Quinton de Kock or anybody else in that lineup, I wouldn't want to be batting with Hashim Amla because he was putting so much pressure on his partners and it's influencing negatively the other guys in that lineup. And had it, I thought it had a destabilizing impact.
I mean, I completely agree with you on that. That, you know, Quinton de Kock coming in would have been the linchpin of the batting along with Favre du Plessis. And they both, you know, 1 and 3 kind of struggled with the kind of out of form Amla was in. Let me ask Kartikeya here. Kartikeya, even before the tournament started, obviously the AB question, AB de Villiers question is there, but they also lost Dale Steyn. And, you know, for a few matches, they lost Lungi Ngidi. Given all that, what do you make of South Africa's tournament? And also, what do you make of, Van der Dusen in the middle order? He seemed to have been the finder of the tournament for them.
Yeah, he's a good player. But I mean, the AB de Villiers thing is a 50-50 call, right? I mean, on the one hand, he's a genius. Mm-hmm. And even with after many, many months out, I think, you know, he's one of the 4 or 5 players that I've seen ever who could like walk into an international side and actually look plausible. You know, I mean, he would still be really good if he played. But I don't think South Africa's batting was the problem. I think their batting was fine. I mean, okay, Hashim Amla was not in form and all that's fine. The last time South Africa had a bowling attack this bad was in 2003. In this bad in a World Cup was in 2003, I think. You know, 2007, they were also quite shaky, you know, the bowling attack, because they had not sort of Dale Steyn had not yet reached anywhere close to his peak. And, you know, that Graham Smith's team was not yet, you know, in its prime, so to speak. It was still building up, but at least it was building up. The last time South Africa were in a similar situation was, I think, 2003, when, you know, Cronje's team was withering and nothing had replaced it yet. And losing Steyn and Ngidi basically just crippled them irrevocably. I mean, they just couldn't get wickets in the middle overs. You know, okay, they have Imran Tahir, but Imran Tahir doesn't really worry. The thing you need in the middle overs in these games is a bowler who is good enough to worry the opposition's specialist middle order batsmen and specialist openers. You know, players who are that good, you have to be able to beat their defense.
I mean, continue, but can you also address what you thought of Rabada? I mean, he's like, you know, top.
Yeah, I mean, Rabada had a below par tournament, I think. You know, I thought Rabada would be more effective than he was. For some reason, wherever I've watched Rabada, I've not seen him. You know, he's a lot like Steyn in that sense. You know, he's not a limited overs bowler in the mold of, say, Bhuvaneshwar Kumar or Mustafizur Rahman. You know, he's not sort of keyed into these. He doesn't seem to have like two different types of slower balls or change ups. And he seems to be sort of a very classic fast bowler in that sense. And that sort of the wickets have been such that that's been of limited effectiveness. Even so, I mean, he was good. But the thing is also that the rest of the South African bowling was not particularly great. And so a lot of teams actually played him out, you know. And then once they were ahead in the game, then he came back, and by then they were so far ahead in the game that they could take chances against him. You know, so Rabada's spells are typically like, you know, the first spell he would go for like 3 and over, and then by the end he would end up by like 4.5, 5. But the South Africa's main problem was the other bowlers. You know, they couldn't get wickets. You know, and they couldn't compete in half the game, basically. And I did not, I mean, if with Steyn, they might have done a little bit better. If with a fully fit bowling attack, they might have done a little bit better. But I think they're at the end of a cycle right now, you know, and especially given the rate at which they're losing players because players are choosing to move to England and stuff. I wonder what their next cycle is going to look like.
I mean, I saw a tweet from Firdaus Munda about even at the lower levels, South Africa losing to, you know, under 19 and stuff, matches that we're losing. And she was like, oops, bad news. You know, it's not as if that there is fresh stock coming in, you know. Sure, they've got recently Markram and Rabada for a few years now. And
Ingram.
Well, Ingram is a veteran now.
Pretorius.
Yeah, but you know, it's not like very high quality cricketers coming through. There are a couple, but let's see how they stand the program up again. Let's move on to Bangladesh. I think for Bangladesh, I think the discussion begins and ends basically with Shakib and Mushfiqur because of how good they have been with the experience and everything. And we did a podcast earlier with Cricket Info's Mohammad Issam after the India-Bangladesh game. So, you know, we don't have to go a whole lot of detail, but I want to get your opinions on one burning thing. Who is the player of the tournament? Is it Shakib or is it somebody else?
Depends on how you define it. I mean,
player of the tournament. If, you're a cricket expert. You tell me.
If you go by the phrasing player of the tournament, just the most outstanding player purely on how he performed, regardless of how his team performed and his influence on his team making the semifinals and the finals, I would struggle to put, even as fantastic as Mitchell Starc has been and as fantastic as Rohit has been, I don't see how you could look past Shakib in that sense. Now, if you're talking about most valuable player, I would definitely put Rohit and Mitchell Starc ahead of him on that argument, simply by virtue of the fact that those two guys have propelled their guys into the semifinals. And I'd put Mitchell Starc probably slightly ahead of this stage.
ICC calls it player of the tournament, and they don't call it MVP.
If they call it player of the tournament, unless you have somebody who, if Rohit scores another century in the semis or the final, I mean, that would tip the scales in his favor, if you're putting just purely player of the tournament. But what he does, both batting and bowling, Shakib, what he does, and the influence that he has in terms of, if you take him out, you've got, you might, if you take Shakib out of this team, they might be fighting Afghanistan for the wooden spoon. They might be winless, and whoever wins that Bangladesh-Afghanistan game, that determines who finishes in last place instead of a team that has three wins and arguably should have had five wins if Tamim holds on to that catch against Rohit before he gets 10. Wow. And if Mushfiqur doesn't botch that run out against Kane Williamson, I tweeted this at you yesterday. Mm-hmm. Those are the two of the biggest moments of the tournament. If Mushfiqur doesn't get overexcited and knock the stumps over in his giddiness to try and collect the ball too early.
Mushfiqur has precedence on this. You know, he against, you know, World T20 against India, he thought they had won the game even though they just tied the score. But then India lost two or three. Bangladesh lost two or three wickets in a row, and then the game ended up.
But that was a mental. That was a mental over eager moment. This was a physical blunder. This was a physical, tangible blunder where he disrupted the stumps. That is, you know, I. The other thing was he just thought he'd won the game because he'd hit a six, and that was whatever, right?
Yeah.
But this was a tangible error that was preventable, and when it happened, you know, Tamim was the fielder who threw the ball, and he was going berserk. Like, what's wrong with you? What did you do? And that was huge. If those two things change. And overall, their fielding was poor. Watching some of the other games, their collective fielding was below the standard of most of the other teams. And if they had even an average or slightly above average standard of fielding collectively, not just those 2 hours, but broadly across the nine games, they would, I think they would be in the semifinals right now instead of New Zealand.
Karthikeya, what do you think? I mean, I know you have very strong opinions about, you know, Shaki was an all-rounder and how great he is or not he is. Is he the player of the tournament for you?
No.
Okay, fantastic.
I mean, I think I would give player of the tournament to a bowler, and if Australia win, which I think they'll be in the final, I think it'd be hard to look past Mitchell Starc, because wickets are worth a lot more than runs because they advance the game and they set the team back. But I think we're missing a couple of players. I mean, if you want to give it to an all-rounder, I think Ben Stokes might be an interesting choice. I think if you want to give it to a batsman, in terms of a batsman whose influence on the game has been significant, I think you'd have to look at Jason Roy.
Mm-hmm.
Because of his approach and because of the speed at which he scores his runs at the top of the order.
Let me ask you, Karthikeya. Like, I mean, obviously, you know, Bangladesh played the first World Cup, men's World Cup, in 1999 to 2019, 20 years.
Yeah.
Last year they played in the quarterfinal, or last time they played in the quarterfinal in 2015.
Yeah.
How do you quantify their progress?
No, they're now a solid mid-table side. I mean, Bangladesh in 2019 remind me so much of India in 1999. Not because, you know, they were in a similar stage in their development as an international cricket team, but of just how, where they were in the world pecking order at that time. You know, India had a couple of good players, but also a lot of average players in that 11. And at this level, games are not decided by who your best players are. They're decided by how many average players you have, and how many of your players have an average time of it. You know, because that's sort of over 100 overs, that's what makes a difference. Bangladesh have that right now. I think, you know, if they can get like upgrades on Mohammadullah and someone, maybe another better bowler than, you know, Rubel, you know, if the next generation which replaces Mohammadullah and Rubel are better than Mohammadullah and Rubel, which I think they will be probably, they will have a much better team. But right now every World Cup they've played, they've done better than they did previously. And that's pretty much, that's success, isn't it? I mean, at some point, they're going to end up in a final. At some point, they're going to end up, I think, in a Champions Trophy final or something like that. And especially if it's played in Asia, I think they have a very good chance of, you know, progressing, because it's a knockout kind of tournament. And I think that will help them. I mean, it helped Sri Lanka in the 90s, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because Sri Lanka in the 90s were also a very peculiar team. They were very, very strong in Asia. But once you went out of Asia, they were not such a strong limited over side, as you saw in the 99 World Cup, for instance.
I mean, that's perfect, you know, because the next side in the discussion is Sri Lanka. And to be honest, before the tournament began, looking at the different sides, I thought Sri Lanka was going to finish absolute dead last. But somehow, through some weird island magic, they have three wins. And at some point, they even had a sniff of the semifinal. Peter, what do you make of Sri Lanka's campaign? You know, they had wins against, England, beat West Indies and Afghanistan. You know, Malinga showed his old tricks. They have a pretty good find, Avishka Fernando, and Kusal Pereira. What did you think of their campaign?
Well, if I compare them to what I saw in Scotland with Afghanistan, when Sri Lanka also toured Scotland before the World Cup and played them in one day, of the two teams that I saw, if you asked me which one is going to win more games at the World Cup, at the time, I would have said Afghanistan.
Yep.
Because Sri Lanka just looked so average. And there was nothing that if you're looking at bowlers outside of Malinga, there was nobody that you were going to lose sleep over. Mm-hmm. If nobody's going to give you nightmares in their bowling attack. And if you look at their bowling stats, Malinga was the leading wicket taker with 12. Past Malinga, the next best bowler had 5 wickets. They've got 3 guys with 5 wickets, and after that, the next best is 1 wicket. And, you know, Angelo Matthews is tied with Cesar Pereira and Jeffrey Vanderzee. Yeah. for bowling 12 balls in the tournament. And that kind of highlights the drop off in skill that they've been suffering from for the last few years. I thought Kartikeya made a great point about the standard, or, you know, what determines who's going to win. Is not your best players, but your kind of mid-tier players, your mid-level players. You know, how big is the drop off? And with Sri Lanka, there's a significant drop off. And with Bangladesh, there's a significant drop off. I mean, if you think about it, like in a war stat context, mm-hmm. right? If Shakib would
for
have.
For people that may not be aware of war, that's a win above replacement comes from baseball.
Right. And essentially what it means is if you take that player away, you assign a value to his performance, that player's performance. Based on compared to an average replacement player. So if you take him away and you replace him with just an average player, what would be the impact that would have on the team as a whole in terms of their wins over 162 game season? So let's say somebody like Mike Trout, American League MVP for the Angels, he might have a WAR rating of 8 or 9, 8.5, 8.7, 8.89. Mm-hmm. So if you replace Mike Trout with an average player, you take the Angels and they could be a 90-win team. In first place for the division. If you take Mike Trout and replace him with an average player, the Angels go from a 90-win team to an 81-win team, mm-hmm. and they go from a playoff team to missing the playoffs by 4 games.
Yeah.
If you take away Shakib, and all of a sudden the replacement is so below standard. If you take away, because that depth isn't there that Kartikeya was talking about, with your mid-tier kind of mid-range level player who's like fifth or sixth on the team sheet, you take away Malinga, this team struggles. If you didn't have Malinga in this World Cup, Sri Lanka may very well go winless. If you know, you have such a drop off in the talent compared to the, you know, the golden age as recently as a couple of years ago, where you had Jayawardena, Sangakkara, Dilshan, that was the core of their batting lineup. And I think it's in some ways miraculous that they pulled off the 3 wins that they did. And you know, Malinga against England showed what a difference maker he can be in that war statistical sense. If you take him out, they're not winning that game. If you take him out against Afghanistan, they're not going to win that. I don't think they would win that Afghanistan game. Mm-hmm. That's the struggle that they're going to continue to have going forward once he steps aside for good.
From the batting point of view, Sri Lanka's, Kartikeya, I don't know how many Sri Lanka matches you watched. What do you make of it?
Well, I thought Sri Lanka would win 2 or 3 games at the start of the World Cup.
I don't know what you saw. You're a lot more optimistic person than we are there.
I thought they would definitely beat Afghanistan, and they did. And Afghanistan, I know that sort of there's this view that Afghanistan were in that game. I don't think they were ever in that game. 180, 190 on that wicket was too much for them. But basically the difference between Sri Lanka and Afghanistan and like the teams, even I would say Bangladesh and Afghanistan, is that they have better players. You know, they have better batsmen, for instance. I mean, Kusal Mendes, mm-hmm. not Jeevan Mendes. Mendes had a below par tournament for Sri Lanka, I thought. But on the other hand, they discovered Fernando. Pereira, Mendes, Karunaratne, and I mean, Thirumane is now really old, but you know, and then they have Angelo Matthews. That's a lineup which is probably not sort of strong enough to compete with say the India or England, but it's definitely enough to beat some of the lower teams. And it's definitely enough to compete against like West Indies, because West Indies don't have that good of, their bowling is not that good. So I thought Sri Lanka would win two or three games. I think the England game was definitely an upset. I mean, it was probably the upset of the tournament. I think West Indies, Pakistan was an upset, and Sri Lanka, England was an upset. Those are the two upsets, I thought.
Talking of country with troubles and stuff, Pakistan. You know, today they just finished their World Cup campaign, very handsomely beat Bangladesh, Shahin Afridi, 6 for, I think that's the best bowling performance for a Pakistani in a World Cup. And he wasn't correct. Selected for the few games. Peter, what did you make of Pakistan's tournament? I think they blundered basically on some of the selections and they got ambushed by West Indies. Otherwise, they should have been in the semifinal. What do you think?
I don't think anybody will be able to explain what happened looking back on that West Indies game. If you look at both teams and how they performed the rest of the tournament, that's going to be, you know, I think the biggest head scratcher looking back over the course of the whole 6 weeks. You know, you had, if coming off the discussion about Sri Lanka's struggles with the ball in particular and their lack of depth and options, you know, Malanga's was the leading wicket taker with 12. The next best was 5. You had Mohammad Amir with 17 wickets. You had Shaheen Afridi with 16 wickets. You had Wahab Riaz with 11 wickets. Arguably, this was, you can make a case, this was the best pace bowling unit in the tournament with how they performed. And so that's 16 wickets in just 5 games for Shaheen, Shah Afridi too, which is just astounding. And you had Mohammad Hasnain, who was a pretty good up-and-coming player, didn't get a game. So the depth there is something to be excited about. In terms of the batting,
I think they stuck with Saqib Malik for the first 3 or 4 games for no real reason, because he had a terrible record in England anyway. And still, yeah. You know, Hafiz, where is his slot in the team? I think that also screwed him over.
I think, well, if you look at it right now, the stats look actually favorable to a lot of other teams, their batting stats, but they could not get the chemistry going on a game-to-game basis.
They had a major drop-off in productivity from Fakhar Zaman, you know. He only got, averaged 20-odd. And he was
poor.
Supposed to be the linchpin, yeah.
He was poor, especially when you consider what he did, you know, thinking back just 2 years to the Champions Trophy final.
Yeah.
In England, there were obviously expectations on him because of that in English conditions, and he was a big failure. I don't know what else to kind of to pin their issues on. You know, you had Imad Wasim only took 2 wickets. I think that's kind of disguises unfairly how well he did. I thought he actually had quite a good tournament, Imad Wasim, with bat and with the ball. He only took 2 wickets, but he was very economical and he did work at building pressure and fill that kind of role. He was a good partnership bowler. He wasn't taking wickets, but he was a partnership bowler. Which again, if I think about the conversation we had before about Gale. Gale is, you know, not an easy person to bat with. Gale looks great as individually, but you don't want to be batting at the other end with him. Imad Wasim wasn't taking wickets for himself, but he was helping to build pressure for the guy at the other end, which flew under the radar.
Mm-hmm.
They had good performances, good nuggets like that, but just in this, you know, situations, you know, if you take the India match, for example, you know, it showed... I just think it's more a case of that. A game like that shows the actual disparity between number 3 or number 4 and number 5. I don't think, even though it looks like on the points table, New Zealand finished on 11 and they got ahead of Pakistan on that run rate. I think there's actually quite a bigger talent gap and a bigger competitive gap between the top four and that fifth, sixth place with Pakistan or Bangladesh or Sri Lanka than might initially appear.
Kartikeya, you know, Pakistan's game against Sri Lanka gets washed out and they lose to Australia, India and West Indies, basically. That's it. And would you, you know, assuming, let's say, hypothetically, let's say they do get to play Sri Lanka, and as you mentioned earlier, they beat Sri Lanka, they would have qualified, and that would be, you think they are a worthy semifinalist, right? It's not like, because New Zealand started well, but then have faded away, whereas Pakistan got shellacked early on, but, you know, picked up the performance, started getting the right people in the team, 11 rather, finishing on quite strong with four wins on the trot.
Yeah, I thought they would. I actually thought at the beginning of the tournament, I thought they would make the semifinal. I think one of the sort of underrated things in this tournament has been the scheduling. I think New Zealand benefited from the way their games were scheduled, where their games against Australia and India were at the back end, and they got through their games against the sort of the lower ranked teams and got to like four wins quite easily. And to play India and England after that is or India, England and Australia after that, after being already on four wins is much better than, you know, having to play them up front and, you know, find yourself in a position where you lost like three games out of four or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, I mean, the pithy way to put it would be that, you know, if just as the game against England was famously rained off all those years ago, if the game against West Indies had been rained off after the first innings, Pakistan would have been in the semifinal.
That is true.
I thought Pakistan would be in the semifinal because the tournament was in England. Because I think that they do well in England because it suits their bowlers and it suits their batsmen. The Southern Hemisphere wickets, I think, tend to be a little quick for their batsmen. And their batsmen don't tend to do as well in the Southern Hemisphere as they do in England. So I thought Pakistan would actually make the semifinal. I think New Zealand are a little, I wouldn't like to say lucky, but I think they've had a favorable run to get into the semifinals.
I want to talk one last topic. You know, I'm sure with, you know, 22 crore people in Pakistan complaining about how the qualifications made with the teams on equal and on same points. Do you guys have any issues with net run rate deciding this between New Zealand and Pakistan? Is there a better way, or do you think this is the fair way that reflects the performance of the team across the tournament rather than, you know, half of the tournament?
I would have a bigger issue with it if it was a case of, say, a couple years ago, say for example, in the Americas region, you would have under 19 tournaments where it was basically a foregone conclusion that USA, Canada, or Bermuda were going to take the qualifying spot to go to the under 19 World Cup. And if USA beat Canada, Canada beat Bermuda, and Bermuda beat, you know, if all three of those teams beat each other and they were even, it basically turned into who could beat the crap out of Argentina.
Ooh.
And Cayman Islands, who could slaughter them the worst. And that was going to determine who qualified, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You don't have that. You don't have that with these teams at this level. There's, you know, you're not going to have an Argentina situation where it's, you know, if India wins the toss and they can bowl Argentina out for 40, whatever, and they chase it in four overs versus if Pakistan winds up batting first and, you know, scores 400 and then they bowl Argentina out for, you know, 100 or whatever.
Mm.
Or, you know, whatever. Yeah, there's a very big difference in terms of how the net run rate is calculated if you chase in four overs versus you bat first. It's a big difference. You're not having that. You're not having that with these teams at this level. So I don't take as much an issue with it. I understand the argument of, yeah, there is a strong case for head-to-head should come first. I mean, if you look at the NFL, the first tiebreaker is head-to-head in a division. If there's two teams tied at 10-6 to determine the last wild card berth, the first tiebreaker is head-to-head. And so in American sports, that's a very straightforward thing. We take that for granted. I wouldn't have any issue with that if they did it in cricket. I understand why net run rate has traditionally been a tiebreaker. So I don't have any issue with it, but, it's definitely a case for head to head, or, you know, if there's three teams tied with the same record, you go to head to head. If one team has two wins over the other team, the other two teams, then that should be very straightforward. I would feel very, very hard done by if you had three teams on 11 points and the team, and only one of them goes forward, and the team that misses out beat the other two teams in head-to-head. They had a 2-0 record head-to-head, and they wind up not going forward. That would be very, very hard to kind of sit and accept. But I don't think it's not the worst in the world.
Katie, you have any thoughts on this, or you don't care either way?
No, I think the net run rate is the best way to do it, because the net run rate is the only thing that ensures that literally every single ball counts. It's like every single ball, a team can choose how much it wants to advance its position in the league. And that is why I think the way India played against England made some sense. And, you know, that sort of awareness, that because it is a competition at the end of the day, right? It is a league. It is a competition between 10 teams for four spots, right? And it is a competition over 9 games each. So over every team gets to play up to 600 balls for 9 games, so 5,400 balls. And basically, the four teams which do best over those 5,400 balls get ahead. Mm-hmm. Because I think one of the problems with head-to-head is that it's sort of, it puts, why should that one game matter exceptionally? You know, it's not that all other things are equal, because the net run rate is not equal. Like, if you get blown away by three teams and win close games against three teams, and the other side gets blown away, beats three teams like out by huge margins and loses close games against three teams, then if both the teams are on 3-3, then why should the head-to-head matter so much?
Fair enough. That's a good counter-argument.
The only thing I would disagree with on that, if you say every run matters, every ball matters across the entire tournament or across the entire league, that kind of thing. If you take a look at, like, a comparison, say, college football, when they used to have the BCS system to decide who was going to play for the national championship, in the early days of that, they put, like, margin of victory. Yeah. Was factored in. And what you would have happen would be Alabama would schedule games against, like, the Southern Louisiana Mud Dogs with Bobby Boucher, and they would beat them, like, 88-9. They would shut them out 88-0. And based on slaughtering, and you could manipulate that, scheduling your non-conference games against the most god-awful teams, and you could pay them. You could pay the Southern Louisiana Mud Dogs or whatever, like, a $500,000 payment just to come and play us, and we'll slaughter you, and you can take $500,000 for it, so we can get a win, and it'll improve our margin of victory on the poll. And then when it came to playing Georgia or Florida in a big, like, SEC clash, if they lost that game, the hit wouldn't be as big. Because margin of victory, they lost to Florida 24-21. But, hey, they slaughtered, Bobby Boucher's team 88-0. Florida only beat the Southern Louisiana Mud Dogs 45-0. Because at halftime, Florida coach decided he wanted to rest his starters and prevent the risk of injury. So they only beat them 45-0. Alabama beat them 88-0. Oh, geez. Well, Alabama, they just... Yeah, it was bad luck the day they played Florida, but look, they slaughtered the Mud Dogs 80-0. They're a much more intimidating team, their bigger team. We're going to vote them into the BCS because even though both teams are 12-1, Alabama's loss was to Ole Miss, and even though Florida beat Alabama, that margin of victory was a big thing, and that argument just kept on getting destroyed because people thought, wait a second, head to head should come first.
That's not really a problem because
you can't really
play around. Everybody plays everybody else exactly once.
I do think that
the question of why teams where games are lost or washed out should lose points is a good one because I think Subhash brought it up at some point.
Yeah, we talked a couple of days ago.
At that time, and that's a good question. You know, why should England, why should Pakistan and Sri Lanka lose points because the game was lose a point each because their game was washed off?
I think they should get both, each of them should get 2 points each. So.
Yeah. But I don't know if that puts anybody at a disadvantage. I have to think about that. But it does seem to be unfair that, you lose for no fault of your own. And especially because in this round robin league, there's ample opportunity to have a reserve day and actually play the game. So they're not doing that, and they're penalizing teams because of the weather. And that's
I would
take an issue with.
Anyway, Peter and Kartikeya, thank you so much for being on the show. It was wonderful.
Thank you, Subhash.
Pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
That brings us to the end of another episode of 81 All Out. Subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a rating, review so that more people can find us. We are on Twitter as 81 All Out. And there is a substantial backlog of podcasts and articles that you can look up on 81allout.com. And just a shout out to our sister podcast, which is a regional movie podcast, called as The Other Banana, and you can find them at whereistheotherbanana.com. As always, we'd love to hear from you, your thoughts, feedbacks. Find us on Twitter, website, leave comments, whatever. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.
India have won the test match. India have won the series. They're going to get back for two. India at home. Lords goes wild.